since October the 7th, I probably can say for many Jewish people that our life changed. And there are many conversations happening right now all over the Jewish world and in Israel. What's going to happen now with our future as Jewish people in diaspora? What's going to happen with Israel since the October the 7th and the war in Gaza? This conversation is not new, and we've been having it since the State of Israel was founded. Each of us have an opinion, and many of us agree or disagree with each other. So we thought that this space is an opportunity for us to have an open conversation, expressing our opinions freely and creating a space where we might agree to disagree. I'm particularly delighted to welcome our guests, our speakers. It's Rabbi Yael Vurgan, who is the rabbi of Sha'ar HaNegev Regional Community and peace activist, and Rabbi Leah Jordan, rabbi of Keilat North London, a member of Na'amot Initiative Organization and coordinator of Azara Learning Project. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we are really delighted to have you on our podcast. And of course, as always, I'm just as delighted to invite my co-host, Phil Dave.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Tanya. Well, yes, as Rabbi Tanya said in the intro there, look, there is nothing new about the conversation we are about to have, but all the same, it feels more prevalent, more pertinent, more important than ever. So I suppose we should jump straight to it. It's strange, when it first kicked off on the 7th of October, I found myself feeling quite, I suppose, unnerved is the word, really. So quite nervous about what was about to happen, because Israel is a country that I am incredibly fond of, and I think like so many of us. And I really did worry, thinking, no, surely this can't be how it happens, how it goes down. You know, after all these years of hearing people spew diatribe saying that they will eventually wipe Israel off the map. And I just thought, no, there is absolutely no way this is going to be the way it happens. But actually, as it has gone on, I found myself encouraged, further moved to do all I can to just dispel any misinformation that there is out there, to try and eradicate this nonsense propaganda that we all have to tolerate day in, day out, about a country that, let's be honest, has made the most phenomenal contribution to the wider world, in spite of the fact that it's actually only the size of Wales. So I really sort of find myself getting more angry now, more than anything. So I shall try and maintain calm this evening. But Rabbi Yael, how do you sort of feel about sort of what we've witnessed so far happening in the State of Israel?
I've been a regional rabbi in the Sha'ar HaNegev Regional Council in the south of Israel, in the Gaza envelope. There are three regions around the Gaza border, and the region I work with is one of them. I work in 10 different kibbutzim. So some of the kibbutzim that I work with are located right on the border with Gaza, like Kibbutz Nachal Oz is less than 1 kilometer from the border. Kibbutz Kfar Aza is about 1.5 kilometer from the border. Other kibbutzim a little further away, but all of them are considered to be the Gaza envelope. And that's the region where I worked for the last 5 years. I said I was out today 14 hours driving from place to place, and I just came home a few minutes ago. It's 10 p.m. for me. You know, in a way, I'm used to this, because even before this disaster, my job, my rabbinic job, is a kind of an awkward rabbinic job. I don't sit in a synagogue in some city and expect people to come to me and to the services that I lead and to consult with me. Rather, even in regular days, I'm used to be driving to the place where people are, in their kibbutz, in the field, in the member club of the kibbutz, and to officiate ceremonies and conversations and meet the people really where they are. I'm talking about very secular Israeli population living in those kibbutzim. And so being a Reform rabbi coming into their communities, I need to be very creative and flexible to bring Jewish content, Jewish ceremonies in a way that they can connect to. that doesn't threaten them, and they don't feel that is abusing their values and their way of life. So my work, even in regular day, demands a lot of movement and flexibility. Since October 7th, it came to an extreme where, you know, I'm using my abilities and the connections I worked on for 5 years, because all of this work is about reaching out to the people, not expecting them to come to me, rather reaching out to and meeting them where they are physically, geographically, and mentally. And so I'm used to that. But in the last 6 weeks, it has been so extreme because, you know, before that, I used to drive to this one area and go from one kibbutz to another. Now the communities, the kibbutzim I work with, about 10,000 residents in the Shaar HaNegev region, they leave, now they're evacuated from their kibbutzim, except two kibbutzim that were not evacuated. All the other eight are scattered all over Israel. And so I drive from the north to the south to Tel Aviv to wherever they are, in hotels, in other kibbutzim that are hosting them. And I'm being, let's say, spiritual first aid for the last 6 weeks, attending funerals and memorials, officiating ceremonies, and mainly just listening to people, being with people, hugging a lot of people, and trying to see, to understand what they have been going through, and listen to their stories, being a witness to their experiences, and try to use the tradition and the words and the language of the tradition to bring them some kind of comfort and maybe hope.
Rabbi Leah, if we just turn to you for a moment, in particular, that obviously Rabbi Tanya mentioned in the introduction how you do a lot of work in the efforts of trying to find peace in that region. Obviously, something like this is destined to set it back. It's, you know, beyond, I'm afraid, help. Of course, it's going to happen. There's going to be an awful lot of people on both sides of the political fence who are going to be very traumatized by what's happened. Needless to say, they're going to be very upset and probably not in the best mind frame to actually try and find some sort of peace solution. One can only assume that your work has been made all the more difficult since the 7th of October.
You're right, Philip. Like, everyone's really hurting. This is what you know firsthand, Rabbi Yael, in a way that I and we don't. Like, you're there. You know, Philip, you say, I do work for peace in the region. Very, very marginally compared to you, Rabbi Yael, as someone who's worked for peace on the ground in the land for many years, it sounds like. I just, you know, I think one of the reasons that Rabbi Tanya, among others, invited me to speak is because I work with a little group called Namod, which means let us stand, which is interesting because a lot of the Israel-Palestine things I've noticed have that word Amidah standing in them. Omdim b'yachad, also standing together, which is an Israeli Jewish Arab Palestinian organization within Israel that works to do peace activism and justice activism and coexistence in the land. And so we're in that same kind of school of, like, you could say the Jewish left or human rights or justice and peace around Israel and Palestine stuff, and specifically from a Jewish perspective. So everyone in Namod has to think of themselves as Jewish and has to think of themselves as based mainly in Britain. It's a place for people to get together and do justice work around Israel-Palestine because we feel like there is, like you say, Philip, a lot of hatred. There's a lot of sense of, like, oh, if you're Palestinian, you can't get together with a Jewish activist in the diaspora, but actually you really can, the way that you can in the land. You can be together. And yes, October 7th set everything back. I mean, because everyone is in such pain. And like everyone in Namod has either Israeli Jewish family who is affected. They know someone who was in the kibbutz or one kibbutz removed. In my family, I'm married into a family where all of my partner's cousins live in the land, and four of them are getting called up to serve right now. And then you have the Jewish communities, even if you don't have an Israel connection, where this is so much in the news that now there's a rise in anti-Semitism, right? And Islamophobia in London. So people are hurting in that way as well. It's affected everything. And I think it's pushed people into their corners politically. I think it's moved people into different opinions, some people, and some people it's pushed us or them into, like, the position they already were in, but very, very firmly, where they can't, like you were saying, Rabbi Tanya, then talk to other people, because everybody is in such pain that they come in with their answer. It has to be the answer, right? There can't be any other answer. And so, yeah, it's a really horrible time. I mean, we all know that. It's just it's a horrible time to be involved in loving Israel and Palestine, loving the people there, wanting there to be equality and justice for all Israeli Jews and all Palestinians in the area.
A couple of things that I just want to sort of pick out from what you said, Rabbi Leah, and I'd be interested to hear the response of it, is first and foremost, I have to express, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of people, if not only here, but just anyone listening to this, who'll be very unhappy with what I say, but I'm going to say it anyway, because I'm used to that. I am personally very uncomfortable with the use of the word Palestine, and I'll explain why I am. And that is because what happens is that when there is no, and I know it's wrong, there isn't a legitimate state of Palestine, because I believe in two-state solution, let me state that very clearly, but as things stand, technically speaking, there is no legitimate state of Palestine. By using, as we as Jews, using the word Palestine, it all somehow legitimizes, it normalizes this narrative of those who say that Israel is an occupier and does not deserve to exist. And therefore, actually, it's kind of sort of almost kowtowing to this nonsense notion of free Palestine. In other words, from the river to the sea. So I have a major problem with when anyone, whether it's in news, if it's in our community, if it's people who don't understand the situation, when they use it as if Palestine actually exists, to me, it's no different to referring to Iran as Persia or referring to Zimbabwe as Rhodesia. You know, it's the truth is, as things stand, it's not a country. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be, but it's a problem.
Well, let me tell you about my last weekend, okay? Last Friday, I was officiating some kind of a spontaneous Kabbalat Shabbat in the hostage square in Tel Aviv with the people of Nahal Oz and Kfar Aza and hundreds of other people and Israelis who came there, and we were just singing and praying together, because it was just the public in Israel is so tuned now to the subject of the hostages and they're being released. And so it was really, really powerful experience. And then Saturday morning, I got up and I drove to Beit Jala to a meeting with Palestinians and Israelis. And I think, excuse me for saying that, I heard what you're saying, and I think you're wrong, because I think Palestinian is not, it's a definition of identity.
But can I just say, I'm not saying that I don't believe that people shouldn't identify as Palestinian. That's very different. I said it's the use of the word Palestine. That's to me what I have a problem with. I'm saying that if anyone who identifies as Palestinian, that's totally up to them. There are people who still identify as Persian, you know? So I get that. But I'm saying it's actually sort of the use of the word Palestine.
Still, excuse me, let me finish. I'm saying I still don't agree with you, because I think that I personally know many Palestinian people, okay, from the West Bank and East Jerusalem, who have a strong Palestinian identity. And that doesn't mean, it's not equal to a wish to erase Israel. And a lot of Palestinians that I speak with, and I've been active in that field for many, many years, they have their own national identity, but they recognize the state of Israel, and they want to live in peace, either in the state of Israel or next to the state of Israel. There are many solutions around and on the table, not just the two-state solutions. There are also a lot of other options that are more creative, maybe more challenging, but on the table and being discussed. And none of the Palestinians that I speak with, and I'm telling you, I'm about 12 years talking to Palestinians ongoing, none of them is talking about, you know, having their own solution on account, how do you say that? I mean, instead of the Israelis, they're all, you know, they can't, you know, it's the talks and the conversations here in the land of Israel are completely different than what you're describing that maybe is happening far from here. Around here, I never heard a Palestinian person talking about, you know, all Palestine instead of Israel. They're all talking about either two states or being citizens in one state. And so it was important for me to correct that. If I may, just another one sentence about the people of Sha'ar HaNegev who suffered years and years of rocket attacks on their homes. And still a lot of them are peace believers, and some of them are also peace activists. I can give you an example of a woman called Liora, and she's from Kfar Aza, and she just lost her son in this attack. He was shot when he went out to protect the kibbutz. And Liora and I also participate in a dialogue group on behalf of the Israeli-Palestinian Bereaved Family Forum. And unfortunately, Liora is now joining the people of this forum as a bereaved mother. But even, you know, she belongs to a maybe small group of people who lost their dear ones now, but still say and declare that they still believe in peace. And like you said, Rabbi Leah, people acknowledge the fact and they understand and they know, because they live in the area for so many years, they know that all the rounds before, all the wars before, never solved the problem. And they realize that there should be another solution, because all this fighting for so many years and for so many rounds again and again and again didn't bring them the security that they're looking for. And people like Liora, not all of them, but there are people like that who say, first of all, they say, do not revenge in our name. And that's, you know, on the contrary of people who I did hear. I've been to many, many funerals in the last 6 weeks. Some of them I officiated, some of them I just went as a part of the audience to be with the people. I heard different things being said, and some of them were completely from a very painful place where calls for revenge. But some people say, please do not revenge in our name. And we don't believe in this war. We don't think it's going to solve the problem. So there are people like that also in Sha'ar HaNegev, people who got personally severely hurt from this attack, but still choose to believe in peace and will continue to do this work even after.
It's so commendable what you just said, and actually inspirational and very touching, particularly hearing the story of a mother who lost her son and still having strength, inner strength, to continue the work for peace. And it's true. I remember talking to my Ulpan teacher one year and realizing that practically every generation of Israelis experienced a war of one kind or another. So basically every generation of Israelis is traumatized, either by the war or living in fear. And the whole kind of, you know, idea of the government portraying as us and them, as often has, you know, sort of the other, and using militaristic ways of solving the problem, it seems to be the only way which Israeli government has been using so far. Do you really think that there is a way forward, a different way forward from now on? And how many people in Israel will support a different way of moving forward?
I think, as Rabbi Leah said, we went back many, many steps, unfortunately, now. But I think the anger of the Israelis is going to come out again towards the government, the people of the Gaza border, the people who lived in the settlements in the Gaza border feel rage towards the Israeli government. They feel abandoned. They feel they were not prioritized. That their rights for protection were neglected because the government has interests in other areas. And although they live within the recognized legitimate border of Israel, because the border with Gaza is a legitimate and international recognized border, still, the army wasn't there when they needed it. I talked to people when they were attacked in their safe rooms for hours and hours, and the army never came, and they had to protect themselves. I hear those stories. I heard them again and again and again. And where was the army? 65% of the army forces were in the West Bank protecting settlers who are living out of the legitimate state of Israel borders. And so people are not stupid. People who live in the Gaza, they understand that they've been neglected because the government has interests in other areas of Israel, and they are angry. And people, I visited the people of Nahal Oz today, just in the kibbutz where they're evacuated to in the north of Israel. And they said, I already brought, I don't know, five delegations from Reform and other liberal Jewish communities around the world to come and visit them. But no government representative stepped foot in the kibbutz for 50 days. So nobody came to talk to them or came to ask them what they need. But the liberal Jewish communities from all around the world come to visit them and to hear their stories and to ask them what they need. So people are in very, very deep disappointment from this government. And I just pray for a change to come. I just pray that people will be able to recover in the personal level, and that the society will be able to recover in a national level in a way that we need a better leadership to lead us.
But I don't think anyone would deny that the present government in Israel is certainly questionable at best, but negligent at worst, right? I don't think anyone questions that. But all of this talk as if somehow it's Israel's fault or the government's fault that the attack happened on the 7th of October, the bottom line is that it's Hamas, a terrorist organization, a proscribed terrorist organization that the Western world in its entirety pretty much recognizes as a group of terrorists, were the ones who carried out the attack on the 7th of October. And it's somehow the Israeli government's fault that that happened. You know, it's
absolutely
just, it is not no. okay.
I'm coming in. Rabbi Yael, Rabbi Lee, I'm sorry. I'm going
okay.
to take precedence. I don't think, Phil, it's Israeli government fault that Hamas, a terrorist organization, attacked and brutally attacked, but certainly the state of Israel and the government's responsibility to protect its citizens. When I went to Israel on the last trip and I took members of our community there, the whole idea was about us supporting WITO, and a kind of well-known Jewish organization who does a lot of fundraising for different social projects in Israel. And the reason we do that is because apparently 90% of Israeli budget goes on defense. So I do think that Israeli government failed its people pretty much not to the same kind of, you know, magnitude as Hamas, their people, but quite considerably. Where was the army? Where were all the defense mechanisms?
Couldn't agree more. I honestly, like I said, you won't hear me disagree that. On the contrary, in fact, I even have my own, which I'm not prepared to share publicly because I have no proof of it, but I even have my own theory as to why it happened. But let's just say there is a hideous coincidence with the timing when Israel was on the brink of civil war, and then conveniently a war with the enemy, in inverted commas, comes along. So let me put it this way. I'm not saying for a second that Israel's government is innocent in all of this, but it doesn't stop the fact that it was Hamas who carried out the attack. It was not the Israeli government that did it. And even if you don't agree with their response, it is still ultimately a response that I would expect any Western nation to do if they were attacked by a terrorist organization as well.
Rabbi Tanya, you answered the first question with the security, and I was going to ask about that. They were very lax in no security, but I agree with you 100%. Hamas started it on the 7th in a big way since the Holocaust. And what are Israelis supposed to do? All through the years, they've tried. I watch a lot of the last night on BBC 4. It was 3 hours from the Israeli wars from 1948. And the Palestinian leaders always say they're going to do this, and they change immediately. You cannot trust them. No Israeli leaders can trust them. And Palestinian people, I agree with a two-state solution, but Palestinian, it seems, really believe in Hamas. They want Hamas. And the people over here, just the the hate in their faces, it's disgusting. More so over here than in Israel, it seems, where you see the Jewish, I went on it on Sunday, over 100,000, and singing Israeli songs and all happy. And even I was against the police because they were posing with the pro-Palestinian children with scarves. You don't see that with Jewish people. They were singing, smiling. They don't want more. That's what's come across.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, let's get a response from
Rabbi Leah.
Tina, thank you. No, I mean, I think it's important to express that fear and that feeling, because I know there are people in all communities and camps that feel like that, that feel like the other side, in inverted commas, as Philip said, doesn't want peace, you know? And I think Rabbi Yael spoke the best to that and is the most qualified between the two of us, her and I, to speak about that. So I would, first of all, underline what Rabbi Yael said, which is that, you know, she was just talking about being in Beit Jala and meeting with Israeli Jews and Palestinians that she knows and people that she's known, it sounds like, for the last 12 years, not necessarily there, but in the work you do. And you hear everyone accepts in the land that everyone's going to remain. And I do think, from my brief time living there, I do think things do become simpler in one respect when you're there. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of hatred between people when you're there, but I lived there on and off for 3 years. In my young adulthood. So not that long, but, you know, long enough to like know a decent amount of Hebrew and a little bit of Arabic and to be in Jerusalem for a few years studying to be a rabbi. And my sense was always that people there know that both peoples have a claim to the land and that there are extremists on both sides who want to ruin that, and that they do continue to keep ruining it, like Hamas and like the Jewish extremists on the far right, like Itamar Ben-Gavir and people in the settlements who don't want, as you said, Tina, for the other people to be there. There are people who don't want that, but there are a lot of people that do, and there's a lot of disagreement on how we got to this certain situation, but I do always have hope that there are more people of good faith on both sides. That's been my experience, both in the diaspora and in the land, of Jews and of Palestinians, that's really what people want. And yes, as Philip said, you were saying, you know, maybe there should be a distinction made between Palestinians and pro-Palestine marchers, you know, because there's been a lot of talk amongst us and the British Jewish community about how in the pro-Palestine marches in London, there's been anti-Semitism expressed. So I do think there is anti-Semitism throughout British society. We've all experienced it. I experienced it in American society, and it is on the pro-Palestine left. It's also on the far right. There's anti-Semitism throughout, and there is more anti-Semitism when Jews are centered in a conversation. So for sure there are anti-Semites that go to the pro-Palestine left and say, I actually care about being anti-Semitic, but I'm going to hide that behind, you know, pretending to be pro-Palestine. Those people do not do the cause of justice and equality any good for Jews or for Palestinians, because they're just poisoning a conversation that's really about, there are two peoples that both call that place homeland. They're going to have to remain. And everyone accepts that they all have a right to remain. And so however that looks, like Rabbi Yael was saying, whether that's a two-state solution, which I, of course, 100% would agree with, or some other, as I really loved Rabbi Yael's words, creative but maybe challenging solution, whatever we find, I'm for, as long as it's just an equality for everyone, you know, and that's the bottom line. And I do think, Tina, that most people agree with that.
So I agree with Rabbi Leah 100%. I think that, Tina, you have a wrong picture, because even here in Israel, even people who are not who don't care about Palestinians, people know that people who, the Palestinians who support Hamas are minority here in Israel. And also the Palestinians who live in the Gaza Strip are also victims of the Hamas government. And the people, almost 15,000 people who lost their lives in the Gaza Strip in this war already, it's like the Nakba, it's like the 48, you know, it's the same amount of people. Most of them are innocent and did not support Hamas, not before and not after. And, you know, almost 5,000 of them are children. So they're definitely not supporting Hamas. They're just innocent people who pay the price As Rabbi Elia said, for the leadership being taken over by the extremists on both sides. I completely agree. The two people are here to stay. We have to understand, we have to internalize, we have to recognize the fact that this homeland is shared. And it's not going to change. Nobody's going to disappear from here. And it's really a question of our values. How do we want the rest of our lives here to look like? And it is a continuance war that, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu promised us that we'll forever live on our sword. For me, it's a terrible prophecy. I do not agree. I do not accept it. And I, you know, I care about my values. And also, don't forget, there's no symmetry here. It's not, you know, we're not two people, you know, living in the same conditions that we can compare. We are a strong state. We are the majority. We are responsible for the people. There is occupation. I mean, people, you know, were occupied in 67 and never released from that. So there is no symmetry here. And I am, as a Jew, as a very, very obligated Jew, who cares a lot about my people, I care about my values right now. Because if I don't care about the others' people's lives, then I'm just like them. I'm just like the Hamas, who didn't care about people's lives. And I want my values. I want to be able to go to sleep at night knowing my values do see the life of others as valuable, the same as mine. Not every criticism about Israel is anti-Semitism. I think it's important to understand. I think some criticism comes from love, not from hate to Jews. Come from love.
I'm Robert, a longtime member of the community here. In my other activities, I've come to know quite a lot about cults, extremists, and high control communities. And they effectively brainwash their members. Is the peace lobby movement doing enough, and do they know enough about how to counteract that and put over their own message in a way that will get through to the children of fundamentalists and change their outlook in the future?
I mean, sure, I certainly am not a geopolitical expert on that, but you know, you listen to people who know more about conflict than I when they're talking about Northern Ireland or apartheid South Africa or Israel and Palestine now or the civil rights movement, and they will say, when a real peace agreement is made, it takes a lot of the wind out of the sails of the extremists. So I was just listening to someone talk about Ireland recently, and they were saying, you know, yes, there are still people who are like IRA militants, but they are very, very small in number, and they still occasionally do terrible things, you know, unethical terrorism. But by and large, Good Friday Agreement really ended that. Because you can't, there's no oxygen to be had. Hamas would not exist if the siege on Gaza didn't exist, if the occupation in the West Bank didn't exist, if there was freedom and dignity for all between the river and the sea for all Israeli Jews and Palestinians. I really believe that. I think there would be people, there always are people who want to grind the sword or, you know, hold a grudge, but you wouldn't have, I really don't believe that you would have the people teaching hate to their children if people had. Basically, it's kind of like what Rabbi El said, people have bigger fish to fry. They're not going to be thinking about what's going on if they, with other people near them and how they're doing, if they're living well, if that means everybody can have a place in the sun to live. That's the main thing I would say, Robert, about, you know, cult thinking. Cult thinking, it's a lot harder to create it in a place where people aren't living in scarcity and fear.
Of course, though, the biggest difference, you mentioned the IRA, though, Rabbi Leah, and I'd suggest that the biggest difference between the situation we find ourselves in now and the IRA is that, of course, when the IRA were continuing or carrying out the atrocities that they were carrying out, it was because ultimately they just wanted Ireland to be a little different to how it actually laid out and how it was. There was no notion that they wanted to eradicate the people around them for it. They just wanted their voices heard. How do you negotiate with people like Hamas, who ultimately their diatribe, their raison d'etre is to eradicate Israel and the Jewish people? That's the biggest difference, of course.
You don't need to negotiate with Hamas. You need to negotiate with the moderate Palestinians and with moderate countries like Egypt and Turkey. And of course, you know, I think the European Union and the United States should help us. I think Israel, we don't know how to solve it ourselves. I think we need to have some kind of cooperation from the liberal world in order to create negotiations with the moderate Arab world. And I believe it's possible. It's not that we need to negotiate with Hamas. We need to negotiate with the Palestinian Authority and with the Palestinians that gave up long ago the dream to erase Israel. And I say, most of Palestinians are not supporters of Hamas. Most of Palestinians don't think they can erase Israel. They're realistic. They see the reality. They're not going to erase anything. They still need to fight for their own identity and their own rights. But there are people who are willing to negotiate and that we can negotiate with. Our governments was the one who refused to, who kind of ignored the Palestinian problem for so many years. I'm saying we also have responsibility as being the majority sovereign state who managed to ignore and not to solve. And we had this concept of running or managing the conflict instead of solving the conflict. And the Palestinian issues was not treated, was just ignored for many, many years. And also, I just want to remind you where we were at just a minute before this started, because I was out in the streets for 9 months with many liberal Jews in Israel, okay, who were protesting for democracy. Because the current government was doing brutal steps against the Israeli democracy. And so don't forget that this event happened, unfortunately, in a reality that was already broken and that was already bleeding from a struggle about the identity of the Jewish state and what it means to be a democratic Jewish state. What do you imagine when you call Israel a democratic Jewish state? Is it what the government was leading us to in the last year before October 7th? Just remember where we were at just a minute before that. We were all struggling to make sure this state is going to stay a democracy. And it wasn't obvious at all because there were some rules that were going through and that were put on the government table that were putting our democracy in risk. And so don't forget that we're still there. We're not done with that. It's just that something came up and took us so many steps back because, you know, being in a state of war enables the government to even furthermore ignore some, you know, democratic rules and values.
Stuart, I believe you had something you wanted to say.
Israel has always had very poor public relations regarding the UK, and since particularly even reference to the government, which Rabbi Tanya mentioned before. Until now, on the case of war, you've got two people who actually can speak up very well. One is Peter Lerner, and the second one is the former ambassador to the UK, whose name I've forgotten this particular moment.
Mark Regev.
Mark Regev. He's absolutely excellent with English language. And we need him to give information on a regular basis so everybody is ginned up, including the Jewish community, who are not that savvy. Another case is also, when it comes, I saw the PBS Public Broadcasting System films and the Channel 4 films. But you see, when it comes to 1948, and the United Nations have given the mandate for the territory of what was originally Israel, it doesn't tell you all the Arab countries then invaded Israel, and then the size of Israel had to grow as a result of other people running away as a mixture, or they were defeated. And this sort of information, I'm having to tell people, because it's before they were born, they're not that savvy to what's going on. And it's a great pity that we don't have more people like you, the people you mentioned, who are that professional. Maybe you yourself, Philip, could fill that job.
You're terribly kind, but I don't think everyone would agree with what I have to say about the situation.
My name's Morris, and I'd like to speak. So how the main question is, what's going to happen within the next 3 to 6 months? Nobody seems, except for the developers and the builders, nobody seems to want to have anything to do with Gaza. It's very, very difficult. You've got over a million refugees, a largely bombed area. Hamas is able to, wants to come back to Israel again. So I appreciate people's ethics and solution and peace loving. We all want to be around the table. But all the analysis I read is that nobody wants to touch it and no one's got a plan B. How do people see the next 3 to 6 months, which is rather than the long term?
I want to say that our first priority, in my opinion, right now should be to bring them back the hostages. And in my personal opinion, it's not any professional opinion, but my personal opinion is that we should pay any price to bring back all the hostages until the very last one back to Israel. And that should be number one priority right now. And I think after that, we need to, as I said before, we need to recalculate the whole situation of Israel and the Gaza Strip, not alone, but with negotiations of other political bodies who can help us find a solution that is, again, not a military solution, but a political solution with what is going to be the government in the Gaza Strip. I don't have the answer to that right now, but I do believe that the moderate forces in the area should form some kind of a federative, maybe a government in that will rule the Gaza Strip. It shouldn't be Israel and not settlers ruling it, and it shouldn't be the Hamas ruling it. It should be in some kind of agreement that will make sure that both the Israeli residents living next to Gaza and both the 2 million people who used to live in Gaza could live there peacefully.
Vex, I believe that you've got something to add.
I just wanted to ask Rabiel, you talked a lot about the political situation in Israel before everything kicked off. What are you seeing on the ground now? How I know you're dealing with an awful lot of other things to think about with war and with hostages you're trying to reclaim, but what are you actually looking at? What do people think that you're seeing of what the government is currently doing?
I think a large amount of Israelis right now are not satisfied with a functioning, with a non-functioning government that we have. So that's on one hand. And on the other hand, I think that most of the Israeli population has moved to a more national way of thinking. And so, again, I think your role as Jews, liberal Jews, if I may call you that way, but I want to say that we need the partnership of Jews around the world who know that you can be extremely obligated to your Jewish identity and want to be a part of a democratic state to help us in this struggle. Because again, the Israeli society is in crisis. in crisis. And I, you know, that's one remark about public. I think you, when your identity is clear to you and you feel good about it, you don't have problem with public relations, okay? The problems with public relation is when your identity is not well-defined and that you're still not sure who you are and what are your values. When you are sure about your values and you feel you can stand behind your actions, you shouldn't have problems to explain it. The problems to explain start when you're not confident in your identity and in your actions.
Sadly, time has beaten us. So I think that the only thing left to do is just maybe to try and summarize, to try and get an understanding of sort of what our hopes are moving forward. Rabbi Lehr, can we start with you?
So I think what Rabbi Yael has put forward and some of the questions that you've asked, Philip, and that the others have asked in this room, and that Rabbi Tanya, the opinions you put forward are come clear to me that those are the solutions, meaning we have to know that we came here because of structural systemic issues, like Rabbi Yael was just saying, that there were successive Israeli governments that ignored the Palestinian question, as Rabbi Yael said. There were successive Palestinian leaderships who didn't lead us to the table the way that they should have. Everyone that I talk to in the land is upset because they feel that they have been misled by leadership that's been quite terrible for a long time. And the solution has to be homeland for two peoples. And thank God I'm not the geopolitics expert that's going to have to figure that one out. But I guess the only hope that I can offer in this moment is it's a terrible moment. People are hurting incredibly from the horrific acts by Hamas on October 7th. People in Gaza and in the West Bank and other Palestinians throughout the land and diaspora are hurting incredibly because of that. So Jews, we are hurting terribly, and Palestinians are hurting terribly. Long story short, there has to be peace. There has to be a return to some sort of discussing of what it looks like for everyone to live in the land together. And however that looks, that everyone has freedom and dignity, Namod is for, I am for as a student of Torah, as a Jewish leftist, as a caring Jew who's lived in Jerusalem before and has lots of loved ones in Israel-Palestine. And it has to be in some way where everyone understands, as Rabbi El says, that no one is going anywhere and that we are going to have to live together. It seems like pie in the sky to say that right now when we're in the midst of an Israel-Hamas violent cycle, horrible, unprecedented in my lifetime as a 37-year-old. We're in a very bad moment. But I guess I look at things like the 1973 war and what happened with Egypt after that that was positive. And I look at the way that Oslo came out of the First Intifada. And I think there are sometimes things can change for the better because of horrible moments. And that's, I guess, the hope that I have for this moment is that, as Yerabael says, that the U.S. and the EU will come and Britain will come forward and try to help. Looks like it's hard to find that solution themselves alone to help to make a peace there.
Thank you for that. Rabbi El, can you please just sort of summarize what you'd like to say, sort of how you see us moving forward from this current situation?
I trust the Jews of the world, the Western liberal world, to partner with the Jews in Israel who would like to see a democratic, free state, that Jews have freedom alongside the other non-Jews living in this land.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Yael, for first of all, for joining us today, but also for the wonderful work you're doing right now with all the kibbutzim and your community. And we would like to ask whether we as a community can support you and the members of your community in any way.
I think the best way to support right now is to support the kibbutzim directly, or to support, again, NGOs who work for democratic Israel and help people to fight for their rights and freedom.
Let's just clarify to anyone who may be wondering, NGO, of course, a non-governmental organization, just in case anyone doesn't know what that is. But anyway.
I would like to say thank you so much to our wonderful rabbis who came on our podcast. And I would like to remind our listeners that we were joined today by Rabbi Yael Vorgan, a rabbi of Sha'ar HaNegev regional community and peace activist, as well as Rabbi Leah Jordan, Rabbi of Kehilat North London, member of Ne'amot Pro-Palestinian Jewish Organization and coordinator of Azara Learning Project. And I would like to say that it was a wonderful conversation and many things were able to be said rather than kept to ourselves, and we agreed to disagree at some points. And hopefully that's a good model and a good example of way forward towards peace.
Can't think of a better way to finish myself. So thank you very much indeed for listening. Please do remember to subscribe to this podcast. Until we meet again.